This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
It meant that something which I think is vital to the future of the county, on which we collectively had put in what I thought was exemplary work, made that case. Kent is very well suited for this kind of thing. Mm. You know, it's a historic county with a strong sense of identity. We have all the public services with the same boundaries who can work together effectively. All these things, and then for no good reason to be turned down, that was, to my mind, awful. And what it's left us with is a situation where local government reorganisation is still set to go ahead, but on devolution, we have no idea of the timeline.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week, Medway Council was left with egg on its face after a traveller eviction was blocked by the courts. A new councillor spoke out against plans to close a much-loved school farm, and the fate of a landmark building in Folkestone is set to be decided after 5 years. Plus, two of the county's MPs have been speaking in Parliament about changes to the Mental Health Act. I'm Simon Finlay, the local democracy reporter covering KCC, and I'm joined by Dan Essen, who reports on the Kent's District and Borough Councils, and Robert Buddy, who reports on Medway Council.
Hello.
Hello.
And we're also joined by senior news editor Nikki White, who's been looking at what's been happening at Westminster.
Hello.
How are you doing? And this week's special guest is former KCC leader Roger Goff, who lost the leadership and his own council seat in this month's local election, which saw Reform capture County Hall. Roel, can you just start with you? What have you been looking at Medway this week?
This week, Medway Council lost a case it brought to evict a group of travellers who were living on the Wigmore Park and Ride, longer than the three-month permission they had initially received, which is a story our colleague Davina Jethro has been covering. The group of travellers, 15 adults and 14 children, first moved to the Park and Ride site just off the M2 in July 2023, and it was designated a temporary traveller site for 3 months. They were served a notice to leave in October, but didn't, and then in December, Medway Council issued a possession order to evict them. Then in May 2024, the travellers submitted a planning application to turn the park and ride into a permanent traveller site, but 2 months later this was refused. The travellers have since appealed this decision, and the appeal is waiting to be heard.
Medway lost the case they brought. What was that?
So the case was heard at Canterbury County Court, and ultimately the court decided against Medway Council, believing the council did not have a justifiable reason for evicting the travellers at the current time. Although Medway Council said it was considering selling the land, there wasn't a solid enough proposal to need the travellers to leave immediately. The health conditions of some of the travellers meant it would likely harm them if they were forced to move. Medway Council did not provide any alternative sites for the travellers to move to, and as there are very limited traveller sites available, it would likely force them into an uncertain situation of being regularly moved on, destabilising them. Additionally, the choice to evict them was determined to increase the possibility of nuisance to others as well, as it would force the travellers to pitch up elsewhere at undesignated sites. Fundamentally, the court decided the possession order interfered with the travellers' human rights under the ECHR.
So what has the reaction to this been?
From Medway Council, Councillor Luella Prenter, portfolio holder for Housing and Homelessness, said, "We are disappointed with the county court judgment not to grant possession of the former Wigmore commuter car park in Maidstone Road, Wigmore, back to Medway Council. This is a lengthy and detailed decision, and we will give it due consideration before deciding how best to move forward. Granting use of the site was only ever intended as a temporary 3 month measure, and the car park is not deemed to be suitable as a long term site for permanent occupation." Councillor Satinder Shokar, who's been supporting the travellers and gave evidence during the trial, said he was over the moon with the result and said the families had finally won something after fighting injustices for decades. He added it was entirely within the powers of local authorities to help and protect travellers' communities if only they chose to do so. The travellers are now hoping to win their application for the site to become a permanent traveller site at appeal, and say they're doing all they can to be good tenants and just want to settle there long term.
Dan, what have you been looking at?
So I'm keeping my eye on Folkestone Hive District Council and the latest twist in their plans to refurbish a giant but long-time vacant town centre building, which has been in the works for the better part of 5 years now.
Which one was that? I think I know which one you mean.
Yeah, so the council rebranded it Falker in reference to the alleged namesake of Folkestone, but most people in the town know it as the former Debenhams building in the town centre. Shut in 2020 and the council bought it pretty much immediately. Since then, they've considered moving the council offices there or turning it into flats or turning it into a medical centre, but it looks like this week they're finally going to recommend its fate for good.
So what's the plan?
The building's split into two. There's one way smaller part of it called Falker 1, and the majority of the building, the huge, you know, Art Deco bit with fronts onto the high street, which is called Falker 2. Falker 1 was the first part proposed for a medical centre, but in 2023, the NHS told the council it wasn't really up to scratch for those purposes. So after considering loads of different options, the council is now set to recommend it be sold off on the open market. The NHS has, however, told them that the larger half of the building will do nicely, so they're also set to recommend the council get to work on tendering contractors for a 13 million quid refurbishment project on that part of the building to convert it into a mixed development with shops, residential units and a medical centre of some sort. But the final call still has to be made by the full council in future, so it's unlikely plans are going to change too much.
So Simon, tell us what you've been up to at County Hall.
Well, I've chosen a story from the other day about the future of a school farm near Maidstone. A New Line Learning Academy has temporarily shut the farm because the mother and daughter team who were running it have decided to quit. And this has led to fears about whether it will actually reopen again. I kind of bring this one up because the person who raised the concern is one of the new intake of Reform UK County Councillors. Paul Thomas feels that it's a very important asset to those pupils who are maybe not so academic or maybe have special educational needs, because it provides all sorts of different sort of benefits for them. But now the school has completely denied that the land would be sold off for development, but has stopped short of saying when it might reopen. So that's where his fears come in. The school trust has said that no decisions have been made, which could sound a little bit ominous since the farm has been there for about 40 years.
So what part sparked your particular interest in this story?
Well, after Reform UK's emphatic victory at Kent County Council's election 3 weeks ago, it sort of symbolised part of the role of a county councillor. It actually highlights what affects local communities. While no one in Dartford or Dover might care too much about New Line Learning's farm, Councillor Thomas was making the point that the deprived community from which the school takes its pupils most certainly does worry about the future of the farm. And when the fuss all dies down about Reform and its victory, you know, the party has to get on with the day-to-day business, and this is the sort of thing that will become part of the new intake's email boxes every week. And there may be huge decisions to be made over massive budgets or local government reorganisation, which are immensely important in the not-so-distant future, but this is the real nitty-gritty stuff which locally elected representatives may well be judged when the elections come round again. Right, Nikki, what's been happening in Westminster and what are you focusing on?
So mental health is something we're all becoming increasingly aware of as something we need to look after as much as we do our physical health. Our understanding has grown in recent years, and with that, the recognition that it's important to know that the right support is in place when we need it. Unfortunately, we hear day in and day out about the growing number of people facing real crisis and how many are being failed by a system which is just quite simply out of date. Now, shockingly, the Mental Health Bill hasn't been updated since 1983, but it's now getting a long overdue overhaul, and Sittingbourne and Sheppey MP Kevin McKenna has been speaking in the House this week about the matter.
So what's the bill about?
So the Mental Health Bill has several aims. They include improving people's rights so they have more say in their care and making sure they are treated with respect and dignity. It will also look at when detention or restrictions on liberty are being considered, with a recommendation that those instances are kept to a minimum. Now, the proposals say that while we should still ensure the safety of both the person concerned and the public, any detention should only be used for as long as necessary. It's also going to stop people with autism and learning difficulties from being detained based purely on those conditions. And also under the proposals, police and prison cells will no longer be used to place people experiencing a mental health crisis, and instead people will be supported to access a suitable healthcare facility that will better help their needs.
So what did Mr. McKenna have to say for himself?
Well, Mr. McKenna, he used to be a nurse, and he says his experience has taught him how necessary this reform is. He said the new legislation will strengthen the voice of patients, and he told the House the time to move is now, and that people have been languishing for too long in places which do not provide them with a therapeutic way forward. It's something that he described as inhumane. He also wants to make sure there is enough support for those services in the community and that they get the investment that they need. He also spoke about a mental health conference that he arranged a couple of weeks ago, and how how voluntary organisations across his constituency of Sittingbourne and Sheppey are helping people who are struggling with their mental health. And those organisations are doing it even when that isn't the main focus of what they do. So he made particular mention of the work being carried out by Curley's Farm, the Challenging Behaviour Foundation, Mentalk at Sittingbourne and Mentalk Sheerness, all of which are helping people through difficult times.
This is a really big issue, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And another MP who spoke in the House on the subject was Dartford Representative Jim Dixon. He highlighted that the changes recognise the need to work with young people from an early age to make sure that their mental health needs are being looked after as soon as the symptoms begin and they're not left to spiral out of control, creating bigger problems in later life. He said early intervention was critical as problems when you're young can hold you back at school, damage your potential and leave you with lifelong consequences. He said it was encouraging to see the government taking action to tackle this outdated legislation and making sure that the thousands of people struggling with mental health are finally feeling heard.
Thank you, Nikki.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Reform UK's stunning election win on May the 1st saw many casualties among the former ruling Tory party at Kent County Council, but no more prominent than council leader Roger Gough. After 6 years in the job and 20 plus years as a councillor, he found himself voted out as electors chose a new path. Roger, welcome to Kent Politics Podcast.
Very good to be on it.
Roger, in 2021, your party took 60 plus seats at Kent County Council and 3 weeks ago was reduced to five. What on earth has happened?
Well, I think it is perhaps symptomatic of the fact that over that same period, we are running nationally at half. In fact, since the election, I think even worse, but certainly half or slightly more than half of the share of the vote that we had when we went to those polls in 2021. I think we know what has happened in national politics since then. I think that the reputation of the previous Conservative government left a big cloud, and there's not been an ability of the party nationally to cut through that. I think also what happened is that there is a very widespread sense amongst the public, amongst voters, that so many things are broken, that things don't work. And of course, at a local level, that translates into the famous potholes, you know, the issue that constantly comes up. So I think that sense that things are broken, things are not working, we want to look for something new, and the damage that my party had incurred nationally, all those fed together to give the result that we had.
Okay. Before we get into your time at the council, what was your journey into politics? You know, tell us some of your background.
Sure. Well, I'm originally from Southeast London, though my father was from Kent. My father was from Dartford, which my brother and I used to enjoy teasing him about, but there you go. I used to, as a child, come down to some of the places that I've now, well, have until a couple of weeks ago, represented over 20 years. So the sort of Ainsfords and Otfords and Shorehams of this world. I had a long connection to politics. Partly my mother was actually quite deeply involved and engaged in it. And growing up in the 1970s, I formed certain convictions that I think, observing what happened particularly with the Labour government of the day, deep interest in history, all those things I think shaped the views I had. I pursued a very different career initially. I was in the investment banking industry, spent 3.5 years living in Japan, 15 years in that business all told, and then went through a bit of a life change on various things. Left that industry, time when Michelle and I got married, we moved down to Kent, our children were born. And at that time, having already been involved in politics, having even stood for Parliament at one point, I took the opportunity to stand for the County Council.
Why did you choose the Conservatives as a party? You know, were you politically active when you were at Oxford?
Yes, I was. And in fact, my involvement with the Conservatives goes back before that. So, as I say, I think growing up in the 70s, seeing the situation of the country under the Labour government of the time, developing some views about both how economics and foreign policy ought to work, I think those are the things that made me a Conservative. It's been a 40-year membership of the party now.
If you look at Kemi Badenoch, the current Conservative leader, and the party you've devoted a significant part of your life to, do you just look at it and think, you know, we're finished?
Not finished, but in very serious trouble. I think it would be, you know, it would be pretty extraordinary if I took any other view after the experience of a couple of weeks ago. And as I say, some of the national polls seem to suggest that the party has lost ground since then. going back to what I was saying a moment ago, I think that the experiences of the term of office 2019 to 24 and particularly 2021-22, that has meant that we've shaved off significant support in both directions. Liberal Democrats in particular to one side, Reform to the other. Mm-hmm. And the reputation that the Conservative Party has had over decades of being the sensible people that you trust to run the country was shredded in that time. And I think there is a very difficult task actually for Kemi Badenoch and for her team to recover that.
You steered KCC through some troubled times, not least COVID, economically turbulent times. Given where you find yourself, was it all worth it?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you never, I think most people, almost everybody who takes on a leadership position, you have the hand you're dealt, not the hand you would choose. It's still a lot better than never having to play that hand at all. It was tough. You know, it's 5.5 years in that role, and at times it was brutal. And it was very, very tough. It was also the most rewarding, most meaningful thing probably that I will do in my life. And there is the opportunity sometimes even to do good and certainly to stave off a lot of bad. And as you said, it was steering the county through really, really tough times. COVID, from the point of view, I'm not thinking of the experience of residents, but from the point of view of leadership, COVID was not the most difficult part,
really,
because there was a clear mandate as to what you needed to do.
So KCC was more difficult than managing the consequences of COVID?
Well, I think the overall particularly the financial crisis that affects not just KCC, but local government across the country, and a number of the other things that happened, asylum, the other border issues, all the economic pressures, and as you say, the budget and service challenges that go with that, they were huge. And when you were in the middle of COVID, the fact was that there was an emergency mentality. And not just KCC, but all the partners we work with and the rest of it, you tended to cut through the nonsense that stops you doing things in normal times. In some ways, once you're into normal times, it gets harder, particularly when you've got all those other things, including the aftershocks of COVID, affecting things like patterns of social care demand.
I wanted to ask, like you say, you obviously governed KCC at a time where it was suffering from very profound financial problems, which no local government in the country has been immune from. But, you know, obviously there's, you know, the global financial crash in the 2000s had quite a large effect, but the slashing of local government spending power by something like 25% over the course of 14 years was, you know, an entirely conscious political choice by your own party in government, first in coalition with Liberal Democrats and then on their own. You know, did not make you think twice about the parties which you dedicated so much time that nationally they were, you know, enforcing these absolutely swinging cuts which put people like yourself, local conservatives like yourself, in a position of having to cut services that people really rely on? Didn't it make you think twice about the Tory party that a big part of your KCC's financial problems was because of their choices?
Couple of points on that. I mean, short answer is, of course, we had, and I think Paul Carter before me had the same view, which was that government was passing down significant problems to local government, and local government took more than its fair share. Whatever your view about the overall budget decisions that government was taking, local government took more than its fair share of those of that squeeze. So in that sense, absolutely. And it's fair to say all through my time as leader, and I think it was true with Paul as well, we were never afraid to push back against governments of our own party when we thought they were doing things that were wrong for Kent. The financial problems as they emerged, yes, clearly what was done on the government's support to local government was a big factor. It was not the only one. In fact, in the later stages, during the time when I was leader, the real problems came from two or three big service areas, so adult social care, children's services, and special educational needs, in all of which national policy and some of the local, some of the arrangements that underlie that were in a mess. They were not sustainable, and they were the things that were putting huge, huge pressure on us and, as you say, on other councils across the country.
Have you ever, you know, wondered why a Conservative government was prepared to let Conservative councils go bust? That's really the way it appeared from the outside.
I think there are two elements to that. Firstly, if we're going back to the point about overall financial support, then clearly that Conservative government took a fairly rigorous approach to public spending as a whole. And as I say, local government took more than its fair share. And, you know, we were, as I say, very, very critical of that. In terms of the councils that went bust, many of them, and there were a number of Conservative authorities and other non-Conservative authorities among them, certainly that first wave there were big mistakes that they made as well. So you look at what happened in a number of authorities with big investments in property or solar farms or whatever it was. Then those were local decisions. But the overall environment, and I would be more critical in a way of the government over some of the policy frameworks that they created. Take an area like special educational needs. I'd be more critical of that than I would of whether particular councils went bust in some cases for other reasons.
Yeah. Kent missed out on becoming part of the first wave of the government's local government reorganisation and devolution, something that left you pretty stunned and not a little crestfallen. What kind of toll did that take on you personally?
That was the biggest single disappointment of my time as leader, because for a couple of reasons. The first is I actually have and had a pretty deep conviction that this was the right way to go. You know, Kent County Council, and again true of other county councils and across the country, is not set up now financially, service-wise, some of its powers, to be the strategic authority that I think Kent needs. And getting this arrangement with mayors was actually a way of rebuilding that kind of strong strategic authority for Kent. I came to that view about 2.5 years ago, and as you know, I've been pushing for some sort of devolution arrangement ever since. We work together very well. I work very well with Vince Maple in Medway, with all 12 districts and boroughs. Doesn't mean we agreed on everything, but we came together actually pretty remarkably and put in what I think was a model submission to government. Our case was very strong. The reasons given for rejecting us at a time when everybody else from Norfolk right the way around to Hampshire was accepted were, well, they were clearly a nonsense.
It didn't make a lot of sense, did it?
I mean, the argument was that Kent's a lot bigger than Medway. Now, I would hope the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government worked that out a little bit earlier than February the 5th this year. And you look at some of the others who went through, and you also have very large counties working with very small or much smaller unitaries. So, yeah, it was a huge blow, and I was probably more angry about that than I have been about anything else, because it meant that something which I think is vital to the future of the county, on which we collectively had put in what I thought was exemplary work, made that case. Kent is very well suited for this kind of thing. You know, it's a historic county with a strong sense of identity. We have all the public services with the same boundaries who can work together effectively. All these things, and then for no good reason to be turned down. That was, to my mind, awful. And what it's left us with is a situation where local government reorganisation is still set to go ahead, but on devolution, we have no idea of the timeline.
Turning to May the 1st, did you see that defeat by Reform UK coming?
To a degree, yes. And it's interesting, because I've looked back on this and asked myself the question. I had a number of scenarios in my head as to how things would turn out. None of them was very good from our point of view. I'll be honest, none of them had us going down to 5 seats either. But what I also had at the back of my mind, and this applies both countywide and my own local experience, there was this nagging feeling of, are we sitting on the edge of an earthquake here? Is there something actually much bigger than any of those? Now, I wouldn't say that was a fully articulated view, but it was there. It was there in my mind. So when we then saw on the Friday morning what was already happening in places like Lincolnshire and Staffordshire, I think I was very clear as to which way things were going to go in Kent. Now, even then, whether I would have expected us to get down to 5, probably not. But it was clearly going to be a very heavy defeat.
Well, I turned up at the Maidstone camp before I went to Seven Oaks, where you were, and one of the local councillors said, I'll be surprised if we get any.
Well, there was a stage when we were probably looking at that, but it was because seats were falling, which were historically, quotes, safe. As I say, I think having seen the results elsewhere in the country, and I thought, well, yes, I think it was County Durham had not been too bad for the Conservatives, but Staffordshire and Lincolnshire were. And I thought, well, we're not entirely like any of those places, but we're probably closer to Staffordshire or Lincolnshire. And there were reasons for it. You know, we knew what this wave was potentially coming. And once you've seen that, then you can think, well, we can guess what the consequences are going to be. So whilst there is an element of this that is pretty stunning when you see it on that scale, it didn't come as a complete surprise.
Do you think that Reform is probably turning out to be more of a Conservative Party than the Conservative Party itself? I mean, the Reform Party reminds me of the sort of Thatcher era of politics in many ways, certainly in the populist sense, in that they swept a lot of people along, gave people hope, and all the rest of it, which no recent Conservative leader, bar Boris perhaps, has been able to achieve. Is there anything in that? Do you think they're more of a Conservative Party than the Tories?
I don't think they're more of a Conservative Party, and partly also because they are a populist party. And that means actually it takes them to various positions, some of which most certainly would not be Thatcherite conservative. And we will have to see what they make now. And this thing's going to be a very interesting test of governing Kent and indeed a number of other counties as well. It's hard to see from what was said in the campaign how exactly that's going to play out, because I don't think there was a very profound engagement, shall we say, with the really big issues confronting Kendall, confronting KCC. But no, I mean, they are a populist party. They certainly have caught a wave. I think the wave that they have caught is that sense of frustration, sometimes even despair, which has come out of 15 years of pretty stagnant living standards, of public services being felt to deteriorate, of also, actually, I think, a more widespread disenchantment with mainstream politics, not only seen in this country. And of course, the migration issues have had a very big impact on that as well. So those are the things which they have seized upon very, very effectively.
Hmm.
What will be their challenge now is how they turn that into seeking to run Kent County Council.
Yeah. Do you think the Reform displacing both the Tories and Labour to become the dominant party in so many areas of the country locally, and long-term national polling suggesting, you know, as you say, widespread disenchantment with the existing parties, do you think what happened in Kent and around the country on May 1st sort of portends the future of national politics, that Reform, capitalising on this widespread disaffection, stands a good chance of completely remaking the political landscape and displacing either Labour or the Tories or both, you know, which have completely totalised British politics for over 100 years? Do you think Reform might be their executioner?
They certainly have some big opportunities. They will face, of course, the problem that every party does when you move from protest and campaigning to actually having to govern. And I think they will, you know, they will have to confront some of the challenges we were talking about a moment ago. Those challenges that we had when we were in office in Kent County Council, the new team from Reform will have to confront those as well. I think the populist tide has further to go still at the moment. How far it goes, I think on the other side of the coin, there is probably, from all what the polling indicates, there is a significant portion of the electorate for whom Reform is a never proposition as well. And what very clearly you see from national politics is that the Labour government is trying to position itself where they would be the receptacle of that, which is why they are bigging up Reform. So I think the short answer is they've got an opportunity. There's ways to go still. And there's clearly a very big job for my party to fight for that space, which ought to be actually a pretty big space of a pro-business, centre-right mainstream Conservative Party.
Yeah, because just going back to what I was saying, I mean, Jacob Rees-Mogg said on Newsnight last night that there should be some sort of a pact, some sort of an agreement, not necessarily a merger, but a pact and agreement where, you know, rather than splitting the right vote, the vote to the right, rather, that you should be working together on, say, the red wall seats where, you know, you could possibly let the right in rather than splitting it. Do you think there's any mileage in that, that there's some sort of a political pact or agreement could be reached?
My personal view is no. I think, again, the Conservatives, we have a set of pretty hard choices at the moment and difficult options, because the situation is what it is now in relation to Reform. But whilst there has been a big seepage of votes to Reform, there also has been a seepage and could be further in other directions too. And I think the Conservatives would also frankly, under those circumstances, end up being potentially a somewhat junior partner within that, which I think would be a very, very difficult situation for us. So I don't favour that. I do, going back to your earlier question, I don't view Reform as a Conservative Party. I view it as a populist nationalist party, which is now going to have the interesting task of trying to turn that approach into how you actually run things.
Yeah, okay. Well, here you are today. What are you going to do next?
The first thing is I've been, in some senses, quite enjoying the last couple of weeks of actually the sense of decompression. Mm. You don't realise until you stop just how much, in a sense, you're carrying. And whilst I would have loved to carry on doing it, you don't control the point at which somebody calls time on it. And if the electorate calls time, they call time. And you have to move on to the other things. I do have, and have in fact been thinking quite a bit about the next step for a while, because this coming was not a complete surprise. Mm. I don't want to go into that in detail at the moment, partly I don't want to jinx it. And there are a number of possibilities out there. But I would hope that the extraordinary experience I've had over the last 5 or 6 years can be translated into some other areas. Hopefully, not only to my own benefit, but other people's as well.
Okay. Finally, Lyndon Kemp-Caron has taken over your office at County Hall and your seat in the council chamber. Mm. I know you're acquainted. What one single piece of advice would you give her?
I think I would say, firstly, I do know Lyndon a bit and genuinely wish her well. And, we'll have to see what she makes of the role. I think it is a hugely demanding, but equally very rewarding one. I think and I'd have to see, frankly, whether she wanted my advice. But the general comment I would make is what I think I said on the day of the election. On the one side, enjoy it. It is an amazing opportunity to do something really, really big and really important. And the other is take the challenges seriously. Identify what they are. We've talked a bit about what I think they are, which are in those big service areas. And with effort and honesty, seek to address those. Because if you don't, they'll turn around and bite you, because they are the things that are making life for local government as a whole extraordinarily difficult. They are still existential threats to all councils, and not just for the leader, but for her team. You've really got to be able to get to grips with those, because otherwise you'll be overwhelmed by them.
Yeah, you don't sound convinced.
I think it's a very open question. I'm very conscious of the fact that the electorate made a choice. They Reform won. We lost. I lost. We've got to be both open and humble about that. I genuinely do not know how Reform will govern. I know Lyndon moderately well and wish her very well, but it's a difficult task. And that's the reality. It would have been difficult for me if I'd come back to it. It will be challenging for her as well. Would be challenging for anyone in that seat, because the situation for local government is a really, really stretched one. And that will be a big challenge for whoever sits in that chair.
Roger Goff, thank you for your time today. Nice to see you, and hope to speak to you soon.
Thank you very much.
It was Margaret Thatcher who coined that famous phrase, U-turn if you want to, the lady's not for turning. Now it appears Sir Keir Starmer has performed a U-turn on winter fuel payments, saying he plans to make the more people eligible. Dan, what's he up to? Is this politics or panic?
I'm sure the reasoning for half reversal of the policy must be political. The amount of money that the policy stood to make the government wasn't huge in government terms. So it won't be that he's had the OBR look at the proposals again and realise it's not worth it. If I had to guess, I would assume they've seen some kind of long-term focus group polling which says that they've suffered quite an awful lot of reputational damage from the proposals to cut winter fuel payments being perceived as, taking it from...
Maybe it was just coming from the doorsteps of the local election.
Yeah, quite possible. It's the kind of thing that is often used in criticism of the Labour government, at least in certainly in my experience speaking to residents all around Kent. But the actual impact it's had, over the course of the winter doesn't seem to be that noticeable. So yeah, I'm sure the reasoning for it must be political, but also I'm not sure if the idea is to recoup some of the reputational damage, I'm not sure it'll work. Yeah, if people are going to remember you as the person who cut the winter fuel payments, the fact that you've gone back on that about 50% of the way, I don't think will make
any difference. Well, I suppose we'll find out in a week or so's time when the next set of polls come out and whether it's managed to sort of recoup any of that. And Nikki, you were following this quite closely at the time. Does this engage the online
Kent Online readership?
Surprisingly enough, we thought that we would get reams of phone calls from people and emails coming in saying, you know, how horrific it was and how tough it was going to be for the winter coming up. We didn't. So what that tells you, I don't know, whether it just means that people just thought, well, that's that, the government has made its decision, I'm just going to have to find a way through it. I can't tell you. I think it will come as welcome news to it's the people who are on that borderline of, I'm not going to get it anymore, but actually it genuinely is going to make a difference to my bill. That's the difference that it's going to be. But I like to think, and I hope, that the people who are now going to get the money, who don't particularly need it, are going to do the right thing. I mean, I know of one pensioner who used to give her winter fuel allowance to her sister because her sister was on benefits, had health conditions that meant that she needed her heating up high to stay warm, and she needed that money. So that money was diverted to a good cause. And I think if you don't know that kind of person and you're getting the money and you can genuinely say to yourself, actually, I can do without it, there's somebody out there who could do better, just donate that money to a food bank, and that can do a whole heap of good. Yeah. Just do the right thing. But yeah. It'd be interesting to see if we, you know, what sort of reaction we do get now.
Very often media organisations are a pretty good bellwether of public opinion. And sometimes we're genuinely surprised about the things that people do get wound up about, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Rob, what's your feeling on this?
Well, just on to add on to sort of what Dan was saying about the public polling, I do know that there was some polling, I think it was shortly after the local elections, that the main thing that people were moving away from Labour, the main issue that they really didn't like the Labour Party about, was the winter fuel cuts. And this was a major issue. And obviously, some of those people will say, well, you know, they've got it wrong, they've decided to change it, and may come back. But whether it's too little too late, and they say, well, if you hadn't have done this, and you know, if you have really thought this through, you wouldn't have done it in the first place, which I thought was going to be the attack line that Kevin Badenoch was going to lead with in her Prime Minister's questions this week, but it really wasn't. She kind of
seemed to stumble a bit, didn't she?
She touched on it a little bit. I thought it was going to be six questions about the winter fuel allowance and really pushing him on, you're doing a U-turn, why didn't you get it right the first time? But I think the first couple of questions weren't even about the winter fuel allowance, and
yeah, she almost like asked an irrelevant question when the thing had already been announced.
And obviously we don't, this is a policy which will actually affect people. We don't want to get too much into the mire of, you know, oh, will this play well in their House of Commons tea rooms and all this sort of thing. But a lot of her questions were about that sort of thing, rather than I if I was in her position, I would have said, why did you ever think that cutting fuel allowance from poor pensioners was a good idea? But you know, maybe
I've interviewed her, Kemi, a couple of times this in the run up to this last election, and you know, you do sense that she's actually a very genuine Tory. But at the same time, she's just not engaging, is she? She's not doing it.
No. And I think this was kind of the best case scenario for her. The government is U-turning on a big public decision that the people don't like. And she, I think, squandered the opportunity.
She blazed it over the bar, as they say in Trevor. Okay, folks, that's your lot this week. Thanks to Rob, Dan and Nikki for their contributions. And don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics coverage. You can also sign up to our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.